This is Monocle on Design, the show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
I think if you write your name and that you are a joiner, that is enough to tell that you're a joiner. I don't necessarily think you need to make the card out of wood.
Surely a new year calls for a fresh business card. Monocle's creative director, the inimitable Richard Spencer Powell, shares his tips on designing a good one and how to swerve plumping for a bad one. And...
in the coming years, there will be a fracturing because I think, especially big luxury brands with money, in order to make more of an impact, they want to go off the calendar.
We're joined by Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters, to talk about what we can expect from this year's fashion calendar. Plus, the founders of Indonesian practice Shau mull over the challenges of Indonesia's, shall we say, idiosyncratic political climate. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. And whether it's minimal and elegant or colourful and flashy, it's more likely than not that your business card says something about the work that you do, and it may not be something you like. To discuss more, I'm joined in studio now by Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell.
Hello there.
We actually have the same business card, you and I, but they were both designed by you. I've gone through the archives and I've found enthusiastic editors to pass me some of the best and worst business cards they've been handed. And I think you're in for a bit of a treat. But before we delve into this, do business cards, in your opinion, still set the tone? Are they still important in the world of business when we're having interactions with people? Do we still need a bit of paper that says who we are, or can all of this be done online?
We probably don't need them, but like lots of analogue things, they're just very nice. They punctuate a meeting very nicely. There's a good introduction, there's a good ending. There's a little bit of ceremony involved, especially if you're in Japan. So I think they are still a good tone setter if you do them right. But there is the bigger question, because so many people do them badly. I think business cards, I'm kind of making this up a bit, but I think it's probably the one area of graphic design that's, or the only area of graphic design that's got a kind of a vending machine solution that you often find in like roadside, you know, petrol stations, where you can go and make and design on the spot 50 business cards of your own, which is kind of how low a business card can be. You can't really do that with anything else except for a business card, I think.
I want to ask if there are any kind of ground rules as well. There's a sort of standard size, a standard weight. There's that famous scene in kind of American Psycho where the subtleties of, you know, whether it's bone or off-white are kind of played with by the neurotic character. But is it okay to, you know, hew your business card out of wood or print it in pink and use both sides of it? Are there any rules?
Well, I think it depends on what the business card is for. If you're a big company, it has to match the letterhead, it has to match the compliment slips, it has to match the envelope, it has to be part of a bigger corporate program, which is why the Monocle business card is quite simple and elegant, if I do say so myself. But it matches everything else, it's part of a program. If you're perhaps a one-man outfit and you've got your own furniture studio, you're a joiner, you might want to put everything into your business card so it kind of encapsulates what you do. Now, I think if you write your name and that you are a joiner, that is enough to tell that you're a joiner. I don't necessarily think you need to make the card out of wood or emboss some, you know, a saw into it or anything like that. I don't think it needs to be so literal. So my ground rule would be don't go OTT. It's not an exercise of showing off what a printer can do. It should just be a nice, elegant thing.
And in the spirit of kind of showing people up a little bit, I'm going to ask you not to mention the names or the companies, if possible, on the business cards I'm going to show you. But I've got some different examples here of different materials. Here we have a whiskey maker, and it's kind of an oddly shaped, I don't know if the listeners heard that sound, an oddly shaped kind of wooden business card in the shape of a barrel. I mean, I'm not convinced by that. It's way too big to put in a wallet. I kind of see where they're going. But what do you make of that?
What I make of this is that a digital printer has visited this whiskey manufacturer, who can't be named, and said, we can do laser etching on lots of different materials.
And he said, wood.
And they've seen an example of something that someone's done and said, okay, great, we can have a whiskey barrel. So I think this is kind of driven by a digital printer salesperson. And yes, it's utterly impractical.
Ouch.
Maybe memorable, but for probably all the wrong reasons.
I've got one here. I would actually embarrass the guy and say his name, although I probably shouldn't, but I can't really read it. It's been printed on a kind of piece of copper that's taken every single fingerprint since it was handed over to make it utterly illegible. So it's kind of etched in copper. It's sort of the wrong shape. I feel like it's a little bit dangerous even with those sharp corners.
Absolutely. I mean, if your business card oxidizes, I think you've done something wrong. You don't need to, you shouldn't be polishing your business card with Brasso just so that it's legible.
Okay, so I'm sensing where this conversation is going. So that is materials for you. We've got some don'ts. I promise that we will supply our listeners also by the end of the show with some do's as well. I'm going to move on to shapes. So I've got a broad array of different business cards here. Some of them slightly smaller than the standard business card. Some of them like a kind of like a reservation sign in a hotel. This little one's particularly annoying. It's just got a number on it and it's half the size of a normal business card cut into a square. Where do you lie on shapes, whether it's cutting off the corners or doing a kind of circular business card?
Similar to materials, it's just there are too many gimmicks in here and they're just not practical. You know, I think there's a rule about business cards that they should be one-sided. And I think that is based on the fact that back in the day when you got a business card, you would attach it to a Rolodex. And, you know, if it's stapled to a Rolodex, you then can't turn it over and get any information on the back. And I think that should be the rule of thumb. Everything on one small sheet, everything you can read, everything you need, all information, done. Legible, clear. I mean, that's what it's for. It's really to get across your details.
But we're going to come on to this. You know, some, if you're working across two different languages, for instance, you know, to have the Japanese on the front and the English on the back, is there a space for that?
Well, I mean, that's probably the one example. We have done examples of that where we've done dual-sided to fit a language on. Personally, I think you can design it and get it all on one side. And I think that's the discipline. I think you should stick to it instead of expanding your design onto both sides and folding it and unfolding it. They feel like stickers that you'd pick up, you know, when you're in a shop and there's something to pick up or something free that gets dropped into your bag.
The one you're holding there is particularly ungracious in a few counts because it's sort of, it's very angular. It's bigger than a normal business card. It's wider than a normal business card. It's sort of the shape of a handgun, if it was a kind of like crystal handgun. And they haven't provided the person's email address. Someone has had to write on their email address at the organisation, which just feels a bit crappy, doesn't it?
It does, and it smarts to me of budget saving. They didn't want to make bespoke cards for each member of staff, so they made a generic one which you fill in.
So we've got two more categories. I'm getting a feeling that I sort of know what your conclusions are going to be from the fact that you're saying simple stock, you're saying stick to the colours. So I've got a few business cards that I consider to be quite good business cards, and we're going to start off with that of Professor and Dr. Eric Speakerman, their eminent typographer and kind of friend of Monocle. He's gone one-sided. It's a one-sided affair. He's stuck very simply to who he is and his contact numbers and stuff, and quite a thick ply on that as well. You'd probably get about four of those in your wallet if you're lucky.
But it's perfect, isn't it? He's not even used caps. That's how minimal he's kept it. It's one colour, it's one technique. It's a standardised weight and shape, 95 by 55 mil, 350 GSM, and it's just who he is and how to get in touch with him via email, phone or mobile phone. I mean, that's all you need.
Well, I'm going to lead you through some indulgences that I quite like on the other business cards. We've got a bit of colour. Again, this is a two-sided business card with the name of the company on the back. Quite hard to read, but then all the contact information. Very bright red. Elsewhere, you know, we've got a bit of foiling, a bit of gold foiling. You're not afraid of gold foil, are you, Rich?
No, I like a bit of foil, as long as it's done nicely. And this is done very nicely. Again, nice and simple. And some of these things we've got here, you can tell that I think that the design is part of a bigger program. You know, you can tell this red one, for example, I imagine their packaging, their letterhead, their envelopes will all match. And that little bit of blind embossing with a logo on the back, very subtle. But I imagine, again, that will be existing in a similar way elsewhere in their overall corporate identity.
And how important do you think it is that those things kind of link up as well? I mean, you're a brand man behind all of the Monocle branding, but previously you've obviously worked on other projects with more commercial briefs. Is the business card a kind of the smallest block in the building of a much bigger kind of suite of services or house?
It's probably the smallest piece of print, more or less. And I think it's important. It sets the precedent, but also it sets up how you should think about a brand and how you should continue to work and think about a brand. Now, if you do a good job on your letterhead and your business card and your bookmark and your sign outside your building, there's every chance you're going to do a good job on the next thing you need to do, which might be an invite, which might be a bespoke piece of print. And then you've got the foundation to keep building on it. And you can look at that business card of Monocle's designed, you know, coming on 12 and a half, 13 years ago. And then you can look at the last thing we did, the last new thing we did, maybe the Drinking and Dining magazine, and they kind of match up. There's a sort of DNA that links them. And I think that's important for recognition out in the wider world, because if you stick to things and if you stick to aesthetics, then I think you can make things long lasting.
And I'm kind of like dispensing some examples I've found of sort of not great business cards. We'll come to this one, which I'm pointing at last. But I think these make the kind of mistakes that someone like myself, who's not a graphic designer, will see. We've got one here, which is by, I think I can say the name of the wine critic, Robert Parker, the most eminent wine critic. Someone here who works for him has his name on the business card, and you can't read that. No way you can read that. Completely illegible. It's his signature. We've got another one here, an academic. He's kind of got a new card, but he's stuck a sticker over it because he wants to use up the old cards and get the correct address on it. That's not great, is it?
No, it's not. This one feels like it's come out of a machine, that's for sure.
So that particularly august university is not investing in its business cards, which I can understand to some extent.
Yeah.
There's a bit more of a creative one here. I have a bit of a moan in the latest issue of Monocle about people with job titles that don't make any sense. You know, your retail Jedi or head of global command or something. And this says the name of a person and then is a, and then a space, and then underneath, what does it say?
Crowd-based capitalist, pattern thinker, bricoleur. Locavore.
Okay, so he eats a lot and he has a knowledge of French. We've maybe given away too much about him, but that space is just inviting something a bit rude, isn't it? You're going to write, this person is a...
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like a question on a comedy game show.
Another one is a great kind of Milanese design studio, but their business card's enormous. And again, they haven't got their own one. And so someone has had to write their email address on the back. And that thing is massive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Business like, cards shouldn't like be making that sound.
It's like a bit of board. I mean, yeah, it's like you could plaster a wall with this thing, I think. Yeah, if you can't bend it in half, you've gone too heavy on the stock, that's for sure.
I'm going to hand you two, because I feel like I'm doing all the talking for you. These are, one is for a photographer, and I'm not quite sure what the other one does, but give us a bit of a description of one of the ones you're holding.
Again, I think photos on business cards shouldn't exist. And if you're, this is for a photographer, and the photo is particularly unpleasant of a semi-naked woman sat on an exercise ball. That, I think, is an atrocity. And then the other one is another photo of someone going down a slide. It looks like a cross between a water slide and a foam party. Oh, Space Hive. I think you need to maybe drop me a line and I can give you some clear direction on what you should be doing. But it isn't what you're currently doing.
And just to finish this off with a bit of levity and a bit of menace, I have a card which I believe is for a drug dealer. I'm not sure where it was sourced. It simply says SID, a phone number, and then the words anything, anytime, any place, delivery 24/7. I actually don't think it's a terrible piece of design. It's pretty clear about what it does. It's legally very questionable. But where does that land, Rich, on the Rolodex?
It's cheaply put together, that's for sure. It's like a sort of feels like a photocopy more than a business card. But you can't argue with the messaging, can you? It sounds like Amazon. Anything, anytime, any place, delivery 24/7. And it's got a fetching glitter ball on there as well. So clearly likes to party, this chap, Sid.
And for the listeners, Rich has just put that card in his pocket and he's running out of the studio with his mobile phone in his hand. Thank you very much to Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell.
Thank you.
And I'm joined now in studio by Monocle's very own Jamie Waters. And if I were to describe his outfit, which is something I love to do on the radio, you've gone rather plain for the start of this new year, Jamie. It's, you know, one of the first days back in the office for us. You're wearing a kind of a voluminous white shirt. Is this the beginning of a season in which colours have been banned?
No, well, you haven't seen my jumper, which I'd taken off. Because it's quite hot in the office.
Oh, it's boiling.
I do. I look very plain and boring.
I imagine a lot of your brightest clothes are in your suitcase because you've got a rather busy few weeks ahead of you with the fashion calendar taking off. Pitti Uomo starts today in the Fortezza di Basso in Florence. London Fashion Week has pulled to a bit of a close over in London and you'll be in Milan.
Yes.
What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, so it's a big start to the year for the menswear industry. I thought it'd be good to kind of go through a few of the topics that I think people will be talking about.
Bit of gossip.
Yeah.
That's really what you're trying to say. You're skirting the drain.
Let's be honest, this is what people want to hear about from fashion.
So Raf Simons was fired. Everyone loves a good firing. Fired from Calvin Klein. What's the scoop here? Why are we reveling in this?
Yeah, so I mean, this was just really big news over the Christmas break, which I think the sort of announcement that breaks the hearts of a lot of people in the fashion industry and I think is going to be analysed over the coming months. Raf Simons, beloved designer, really talented, a fashionista's designer because he has a lot of interesting references. He's very sort of artistic and creative. He was brought into Calvin Klein, which was doing well as a brand off the back of all its underwear sales and things. But Ralph was brought in to make it cool, essentially. And he had his own very high-end line. And then the point was that it was meant to have a sort of halo effect where it became very arty and high fashion. And then that would sort of trickle down into just bigger sales for the brand. That just didn't sort of play out over his time there. It wasn't selling well. The profits decreased. And it's just an interesting thing because I think in fashion in recent years, there's been this thing where people think you hire a superstar designer, give them full control over the brand, because Ralph was doing everything. He was doing all the store things. He was doing every men's, women's collection, accessories. This is a thing that we're now seeing at Celine with Eddie Slimane. We've seen it at Gucci with Alessandro Michele. At Gucci, it's worked spectacularly. But I think this was something of a cautionary tale where it hasn't done that. And he was perhaps too cool for what the brand is. It's an underwear brand, is its bread and butter.
And from the basics, Jamie, to the window dressing, you'd like to talk about Dior and their rather elaborate pre-fall menswear show in Tokyo at the end of last year. So if we've got our basics from Calvin Klein, assuming that's where you buy them, we've got to think about how fashion is kind of showcased, how the window dressing is done and how excitement is generated. Did Dior do something that other fashion brands, do you think, would like to tap into with that show?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing to talk about when we look to the year ahead and the years ahead for what will happen with menswear shows, because Dior did something unprecedented in that they held a pre-fall menswear runway show. So they did it in Tokyo. They did a catwalk collection. Now, pre-fall cruise shows, these kind of inter-seasonal shows is something that women's wear has done for the last kind of 15 years. And these inter-seasonal lines are hugely profitable for brands. Some menswear brands do it, but they don't do shows. They would maybe do a small presentation.
Is this the kind of death knell for the traditional season for two shows a year? You know, we've moved into having four shows a year and people's accessory lines becoming a big part of their business. But are, you know, pre-fall or pre-cruise or even something in between that going to be the next big thing, the kind of fracturing of the traditional calendar?
I mean, in women's wear, we're still seeing the spring, summer and autumn, winter, the two core seasons. I mean, they still run, they still have big shows. I think generally that in the coming years, there will be a fracturing because I think, especially big luxury brands with money, in order to make more of an impact, they want to go off the calendar. They want to show in LA or in Shanghai or somewhere different where they can fill up people's social media feeds, have different images. They stand out. They're not kind of crammed into a regular calendar in Paris or something. So I think it's something we'll see more and more. Whether the actual traditional fashion weeks will peter out, I mean, I'm not sure if that's the case.
Not going to put your reputation on the line about that one just yet.
I think what it will mean if menswear brands do this thing is that there will just be even more focus given to luxury brands because they're the ones that have the money to do this thing.
And last but not least, you know, we're talking about Dior kind of jumping the gun a little bit, getting out of the stable quickly to show off an elaborate collection. You've refused to put your reputation on the line. I'm very angry about that. I try and coax all of my guests into saying something they'll regret. But
don't worry, you've still got time.
Yeah, we've still got time. But I'm looking ahead to Paris Men's Fashion Week, which as someone who's kind of unacquainted with the industry, that's me, of the two of us, it always seems to have rather a strong reputation. And I believe that you agree with me there. Paris Men's has gone from strength to strength.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing in the men's industry is Paris keeps getting stronger and sort of swallowing up all the big name brands. And London's just finished. London Men's, unfortunately, keeps losing names and just sort of keeps getting smaller.
London's finished. You heard it here first, everyone.
Milan, it has its marquee names. It still has Prada. But generally, Paris is just so much stronger than the others. And I think this season it's even stronger. I mean, a few of the shows that are sort of going to be getting a lot of attention. Celine is closing the schedule. This is obviously Eddie Slimane. His debut, which was during Women's Wear last September, was hugely provocative, had everyone up in arms. He's a master at sort of causing controversy and getting, you know, a master marketer. That's at 8 p.m. on the Sunday nights. That is the last show. And so Jonathan Anderson's, he's the creative director at Loewe. He also has his own line, JW Anderson. He's left London, where he normally shows. He's British. He's left London to show in Paris. So there is talk about whether, you know, increasingly, whether it's in buyers' interest to go to the others or whether they should just go to Paris. A lot of press, it's like, do you leave Milan early? Do you bother with some of the others?
And in the interest of balance and probably having a little time away from the office, Jamie Waters will be in Florence for Pitti Uomo. You'll be going to Milan and will also be reporting from Paris Fashion Week across the Monocle 24 schedule. Jamie Waters, Monocle's fashion editor, thank you very much. Next up, we head to Indonesia, where Sha'u is a young architecture practice run by partners Daliana Surawinata and Florian Henselman. While the firm's output is varied, they've been spotlighted on the international design map for the work they've done to revitalise the Indonesian city of Bandung, in collaboration with the metropolis's architect-turned-star mayor, Ridwan Kamil. With design for vibrant public spaces in Bandung already a success, Sha'u has turned its attention to a self-initiated project around creating public micro-libraries. What are they, you ask? Well, the pair joined Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, to turn the page and tell him just a little more.
In a way, there are many architecture offices starting in the periphery of Jakarta called Bintaro, and they teamed up and made exhibitions, open offices, and so on. As well in Bandung, there is a new vibe of young architects being more active in the organization, and they bring in different communities together to arrange talks, exchanges, and exhibitions. So I think the vibe is really amazing and it's growing, I would say.
In terms of architecture that's happening there, I'm guessing there's a lot that people in other parts of the world can learn. Obviously, you have quite a unique climate there, but also you have these massive growing cities, you're having to do things on a certain budget. What can the rest of the world, or maybe just the region a little bit more broadly, learn from architecture that's happening in Indonesia at the moment?
Well, Indonesian cities are recently making new public spaces, and these public spaces are being produced right now, not in the past. And these public spaces will then take on the users' needs and desires, and this would be then a different types of public spaces than ever created in the past. Cities like in London, in Paris, there will be different kind of typology, I would say. And what is really nice is that recently some of the people in the top government are open to include Indonesian architects to take part in building these public spaces. So there is a lot of promise ahead and different take on how to interpret tradition in the contemporary architecture, tropicality.
One of the other main commissions that you guys have had is to design a series of micro libraries across Bandung. Can you tell us a little bit about that brief?
The thing with the micro libraries is actually it was more of a self-initiated project. So we had the chance to talk with one of the directors of Dompeduava, which is a charity organization from Indonesia, and we started the project, or the first one, with them. But it took quite a while till we could find a site, and then it happened to be in Bandung, the first site, and that's the first microlibrary. And then from that on, we could start building different ones, and partly in Bandung and partly also one is in Bojonegoro. So it's not only Bandung-based, it's also not only one person-based. Of course, again, Ridwan Kamil is a great supporter, but there are different interested parties there as well. So sort of now we have a critical mass of microlibraries, and yeah, we will see how this, from that moment on, can build up even more.
And Diana, in terms of these microlibraries, can you tell us about some of the constraints? I'm guessing, you know, there's probably a limited budget, but also you're trying to maximize the space for the people. What have been the challenges of designing and building these?
Yeah, so it's a self-initiated project, as Florian mentioned. And the mechanism of every microlibrary is that it fits with the budget of a CSR of a company would give. So it would fit perfectly, and especially in Indonesia, where that amount of money that the company would allocate would be enough to build a beautiful small library. So we find the stakeholders, we find the funder, the city need to cooperate with us in terms of giving the land. And we are in between arranging everything, designing it, and making sure that things are happening with different collaborators and so on. So there are many challenges depending on which site we are designing the microlibrary at.
Why is it so important to be really focused on these microlibraries?
I think it's time that architects take a different role than just waiting for briefs to be written and design it for the brief, but also to take a stand and become one of the stakeholders. And in that way, as project initiator, there is a different take on the project itself, not as someone being told to design, but to initiate it and arrange everything else. And this would then result in us having an amount of freedom to design. And it is very important as an architect to be able to exercise and explore different materials, different forms, different way of programming it, and be able to communicate it at the same level as the owner of the project and the funder. So that's what's very interesting for us to do these microlibraries as well.
And Florian, in terms of the microlibraries, I understand there's a fourth that's just being completed. Daliana was talking about the materials and having that little bit of freedom to be a little bit creative and playful with the design. Could you perhaps unpack the design of this fourth microlibrary?
The fourth one, which is currently, or which is almost completed, is in Babakan Sari in Bandung 2. We call it the Hanging Gardens microlibrary. So what we learned from the first one, let's say from the Bima one, is that we want or we need to create added value. So we need to pick a place which is already frequented by people and add functionality, which happened maybe sort of in the beginning, sort of intuitively. In the last one we are building, we really made it very explicit. So basically, it's a library which is integrated in a big planter stair, which is swirling up or going around a public place. And we will involve a gardening or a urban farming community that they can grow plants there. So the whole idea is how to activate the whole neighborhood. So we have an elementary school next to it. So maybe there could be a piece of school garden, because we learned from the other library that some schools don't have libraries, so they sent their kids over. We made a slide there to lure the kids in to, you know, playfully read books. And so, yeah, we would like to give more program and more functionality other than a library to a certain location to really attract a lot of people, to make it lively, to build up community. So really the base point is to make it work is a active community.
And just finally, for other developing cities in Southeast Asia or even further afield, what would you say the key takeaways from the success stories in Bandung are? Because a lot of it was done after there were existing problems in the city, and it's kind of reverse engineering in a way. What can other cities that have similar problems learn?
Yeah, I think the perfect visionary leader is really the key to any development. We've seen it from Edi Rama, Ridwan Kamil being some of the very inspiring leaders, and they would work with some of the best architects tackling very clear problems. For example, just take one topic and there are many things to do about it. So a pilot projects which are feasible to do within 3, 4, 5 years, that's the key to any mayor in the world. But also not to forget the long-term planning afterwards, and that's very often forgotten with leaders who are being elected only for a 5-year office. And that's really, really necessary for the sustainable planning of the whole city, to think about the future after what happens after 5 years.
That was Daliana Suryawinata and Florian Henselman speaking to Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles. Sadly, that's all the time we have on this week's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show or our brilliantly named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, the Forecast, the February issue, or one of our winter weekly newspapers. All are available on all self-respecting newsstands or from monocle.com. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnizes and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.